Talking History on News Talk.
Instantly recognizable music of Bizet's Carmen. Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the life and music of a composer who died at the age of 36, but whose legacy included one of the most loved operas in the world. And we've heard some of its music there, Carmen, as we explore the world and work of Bizet. We'd love you to join our discussion. Just send us a text, 53106, and don't forget, text costs 30 cents. Or you can drop us an email, talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we debated the reputation of the protagonist of Wolf Hall, that's Thomas Cromwell. We also discussed the life of Cottle Brewer and explored the connections between southern Italy and the American Confederacy in the 19th century in our monthly book show. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or go directly to iTunes. During the week, the acclaimed Irish historian David Fitzpatrick passed away, and I want to pay tribute to one of my colleagues in Trinity, who was one of the pioneers of historical scholarship in this country. His work on Clare during the War of Independence and Civil War became the template for other regional studies, and in this and so many other areas, he transformed how historians approach 20th century Irish history. He was also a superb teacher, innovative and engaging, and I remember when I started in Trinity, I went to him for advice on how he organised his courses, and he would have his students cook the recipes from the First World War. He would have them sing the songs of the period in class. He would have them reenact things. He would have them publish pieces. And he really was an incredible inspiration for many generations of scholars. And he will be very deeply and sadly missed. He was a generous colleague and friend, and we want to offer our condolences to his wife and his children. In tonight's show, we're looking at the life and music of Bizet. Born in Paris in October 1838, Georges Bizet attended the Paris Conservatoire and showed extraordinary talent from an early age as a pianist. He began composing in the 1850s and spent 3 years in Italy, where he wrote the opera Don Procopio. In 1870, he enlisted in the National Guard during the Franco-Prussian War and greeted the new French Third Republic with enthusiasm. His opera Carmen was first performed in March 1875, but some audiences were hostile, with some people repelled by its tone and content. Suffering from depression and ill health, Bizet died a few months later in June 1875. Today, Carmen is one of the world's most loved operas, and Bizet's reputation is far greater than it was in his lifetime. So in tonight's show, we want to strip away the romantic myths and misrepresentations and explore the life, the work and the legacy of the composer and his music. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Susan McClary is Professor of Music at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio and Distinguished Professor Emerita at UCLA. And her books include the Cambridge Opera Handbook, Georges Bizet Carmen, and Feminine Endings, Music, Gender and Sexuality. Jonathan Darnborough is Director of Studies in Music at Oxford University Department for Continuing Education, and he teaches Bizet's Carmen among his other courses there. He's an award-winning composer and pianist and has been described as having a compositional voice that is unmistakably his own, and he is currently working on an opera based on Euripides' Hecuba. Professor Wolfgang Marx lectures in the School of Music at UCD and leads the research strand death, burial and the afterlife. His main research interests are the representations of death in music, the composer Ligeti and the theory of musical genres, and he has sung in the choir for a production of Carmen. Dr. Rachel Talbot lectures in opera at the DIT Conservatory of Music and Drama. She performs as a recitalist, soprano soloist in oratorio and as a member of early music and chamber ensembles and has directed a number of operatic productions. Dr. Laura Watson is a lecturer in music at Maynooth University. One of her areas of expertise is fin de siècle and early 20th century French musical culture, and she is the author of the book Paul Dukas, Composer and Critic, which will be published in spring by De Boydell Press. Well, you're all very welcome. And Laura, I might begin with you. And I might begin, really, I suppose, at the end of Bizet's life, because he died at that age of 36. And to what is it really the case that he died something of a, or considering himself something of a failure, because Carmen was getting something of a hostile reaction, and he didn't have that sense of appreciation that exists now?
Yeah, I mean, it's true to say he wasn't appreciated enough in his own time. When Carmen premiered, there were some critics who welcomed the opera, but there was an awful lot of criticism as well. He wasn't really appreciated as a composer on his own terms. He was often compared to Wagner. And even during the production of the work, there were people, musicians in the orchestra, the chorus members were saying that they couldn't possibly perform this work. It was far too difficult. Meanwhile, a couple of decades later, there were other people, such as the French composer and critic Paul Dukas, who said that Bizet was in fact a genius, he was an innovator, and his ideas were simply too advanced for the musical authorities of the time. So there was some recognition by about the 1880s or the 1890s that Bizet was a really important French composer. And of course, by that time, there'd been lots more productions of Carmen. So people had had a chance to reevaluate the music and I think give him the credit he deserved.
Susan, it's very interesting when you look at the reaction to Carmen and his death so soon afterwards. I read somewhere that I think there was only 33 performances of Carmen by the time he died, and some theories that his heart was broken, others that he was suffering from depression and ill health. He died so soon after the production of Carmen. Is there a sense there of the promise that was lost, the potential, what might have happened next?
I think that's absolutely so. But I think we can't use the Mozart narrative that he dies of a broken heart because of this and so on. I mean, Bizet had been in ill health. He had problems with his respiratory system, with his heart, and he did die of a sequence of heart attacks, so of natural causes. It's very easy for us to look back and say, oh, he wasn't understood and this broke his heart. But I think that the death was owing to natural causes. He was extremely disappointed because he did see Carmen as a new path forward for him. And we can't really even imagine what he would have done next. He might have given us a whole series of fantastic pieces. If Verdi had died at that age, you know, we probably wouldn't remember him. He was very, very young, and then he died with this one extraordinary masterpiece. And yes, we have all wanted very much to imagine the trajectory he might have followed if he had lived longer.
Very interesting. Richard has texted in on 53106 to say that Bizet composed the Toreador song, that's part of Carmen as well, and it was adopted then as Munster's rugby anthem, Stand Up and Fight, and he says, please play it. Well, Richard, just for you and for all the Irish rugby fans who, I don't know how they're feeling tonight after an unconvincing win against Italy, we will definitely play, and maybe we might finish the show tonight with that piece of music. Please send in your comments, your questions 0818 536 106. Wolfgang, very interesting what Susan said there. She called Carmen that one extraordinary masterpiece. I suppose the question then is whether Bizet was more than just a one-hit wonder.
Yeah, there are a few other pieces, one or two, that are still regularly played, not as often as Carmen. There's particularly the two La Lassienne suites, although one of them at least is also arranged, but not by him, by his close friend Ernest Guiraud, who also then was involved in making Carmen more popular by writing the recitatives. But yeah, he had continuously the problem that he had lots of ideas. He worked on something like between 25 and 30 operatic projects throughout his life, and only a handful of those ever got finished. He was not that well regarded by, well, some of his fellow composers rated him highly, but certainly the people who were responsible for commissioning operas or for organizing concerts were not that much. It was a time when, not unlike today in with regard to classical music, perhaps, anything that was new was looked at with suspicion. So what you have, the secure things that will bring in the crowds, that is going to be performed. New pieces have to be similar, or otherwise it's too much of a risk to stage them. And he suffered from that. And he often didn't finish pieces, often didn't even start them, or destroyed some of his scores, and made his living for a long time by actually arranging music by others for publishers, and also did a bit of teaching and piano and composition, but very rarely made sufficient amount of money for himself from his compositional activity, which is a pity, but that's the way it was then, obviously. And it looks like, I found it interesting to compare that today, where again, many composers, if they make a living, they do that by teaching, very rarely through commissions alone.
Very good. So it's back to that cycle. Jonathan, it's very interesting there to hear Wolfgang talk about his life as a composer and struggling to get by and to make ends meet. He was an experimental composer. He was ambitious. And although he's best remembered now for Carmen, he was in his lifetime quite prolific.
Yes, indeed. In fact, it was his stated ambition that he wanted to revolutionize opéra comique. And obviously, Carmen is the epitome of that ambition.
Very good. And when you look at, I suppose, the things that stand out, when you're looking at him as someone who, say, is involved in music as well, composing and writing, what is it about Bizet that stands out? Is it his use of rhythm? Is it the harmonic touches? What is it about him as a composer that I think is distinctive?
Well, I think probably the most obvious thing is his gift for melody. His melodies have a very natural flow to them. They develop sometimes very extensively. He manages to mold his phrases in such a way. In fact, he's not always perhaps the most, how shall I put this, when he's setting the French words to music, he's not always that concerned about the speech rhythms. Perhaps the most obvious example of that is in the Toreador's song, but one can find other examples throughout. But nonetheless, although he is sometimes a little bit cavalier with regard to the speech rhythms, the melodies that he writes are so unforgettable and so natural and so flowing, and on their overall design, so very well crafted, so that the build-up to the climactic moment in an aria is always beautifully contrived. And underpinning all that is a real command of harmony. Now, of course, he was well aware of Wagner's example, but he couldn't help but perhaps absorb some of Wagner's examples, but he was not keen on Wagner. He really stated that he was not interested in Wagner's music. Lots of composers said that, and it was not always the case that they were nevertheless immune to Wagner's influence. But it's certainly true that the French Romantic movement doesn't explore such extreme chromaticisms as Wagner pioneered. The music of Gounod and Bizet, Massenet, all of these composers, they are perhaps more wedded to the tonal system. Their music is more often staying closer to the key in which it starts. We'll see later when we talk about the contrast between Carmen's music and the other music in Carmen, the way in which he departs from that norm in order to characterize Carmen. But the distinctive thing about the French Romantics was that although they may not have used chromaticism in such a way that the sense of key was lost, what they did do was to use far more additional notes to the basic triads of the key. So added sixths, added sevenths are a very common flavour in that later French Romantic music. And that leads straight on into the music of Fauré, Ravel, Debussy, where those chords with added sixths and sevenths are absolutely standard.
Very good. Rachel, can I ask you for a singer's perspective on Bizet? What's it like to perform him?
Bizet is very grateful to sing. And if you look in the literature that's advising singers on how to prepare roles or how to categorise their voice, it's surprising how little you find, because all it'll do is remind you to sing with a beautiful line, make sure that you have beauty of tone, never to force. One thing that's interesting with Bizet is that he never favours a darker sound or a heavier sound. So while Verdi's operas were, particularly for the mezzo-soprano, making a quite a darker sound and looking for extremes in sound to characterise, Bizet was never characterising by altering how a voice sounded. The voice is always going to be beautiful, and it was his composition that brought the drama in, and not by trying to stretch the limits of the voice. So it was always an elegant, a warm sound. The singer who created the role of Carmen, Célestine Galimardier, she was sort of a lighter mezzo-soprano. She had beautiful sound, but it wasn't large. It wasn't a very large range. And that really, Bizet really knew how to make a voice sound beautiful. And when you sing it, it's a very pleasurable thing to do. And it's so, people don't sort of use him as a linchpin in training of you, and then you'll move and learn how to do the Bizet technique, because somebody who's sung Wagner or somebody who's sung Mozart can come and sing Carmen, and you can see a wide variety of different sorts of voices will take that role and can all sound beautiful in it.
Very good. Laura, we asked you to select a piece of music for us, and we might play out to our first ad break with it. What did you select and why?
So I chose one of Bizet's very earliest works. It's his Symphony in C, which he composed when he was only 17. And the reason I've chosen this is that we don't often think of Bizet as a symphonist. He has, you know, he established his reputation in opera. But this is a work where it's very much influenced by his studies at the Paris Conservatoire. And it's an extremely accomplished work for something that a 17-year-old composer wrote. But there's another story to the symphony, which is the fact that Bizet suppressed it from the public. And he never bothered to tell publishers that he had this four-movement complete symphony ready to go. And so it was more or less kind of rediscovered in the 1930s, and it was given its first live performance in 1935. So the excerpt I've chosen is from the second movement, where again Bizet's great gift of melody, which we've already heard Jonathan talk about, comes across here. And this music that we're going to hear is music, in fact, that Bizet would recycle in a later work. So this is part of the reason maybe why he didn't tell people about this symphony, because he went back to it as a mature composer. He took melodies from it and he reused it in later music. So the music that we're going to hear now was reused in the opera, The Pearl Fishers.
Thank you.
Talking History. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we explore the music and life of Bizet. I'm delighted to be joined by Susan McClary, Jonathan Darnborough, Rachel Talbot, Laura Watson, and our resident go-to expert for all our classical music shows, and that is Wolfgang Marx. And Jonathan, I might start back with you and a similar question to what I asked Rachel. What's it like to play Bizet as a pianist?
Very natural. I mean, there are stories of him playing sight reading music by Liszt and astonishing Liszt. So he clearly was a very good pianist. And the irony of that is that he avoided becoming known as a pianist because he felt that actually would damage his reputation as an opera composer. He seemed, probably quite rightly, he reckoned that the two things were mutually exclusive occupations. And he was, as we know, dedicated to becoming an opera composer. And so he sort of kept his piano playing light under a bushel. But he writes for it absolutely idiomatically.
You have a piano nearby. I wonder, could we persuade you to play our listeners a short piece?
Well, I was going to illustrate a few extracts from Carmen to talk about the way that he characterizes Carmen musically. So perhaps that would be the best thing to do.
That sounds perfect.
Okay. So as I said earlier, the French Romantic style was something which remained quite wedded to the key that it was in. And we see Bizet using that style for really all of the characters that are not Carmen in the opera. So Don Jose, in his famous flower song, sings this. Now, all of that, despite having some rather scrunchy harmonies, things like and so on, all of that stays very wedded to the that happens to be the key of D flat major, but it could be any major scale. His melody has hardly any notes. It does have a few, but they're only passing things. His melody has hardly any notes that are not part of that scale. The harmonies have almost, actually, they have, up to the point where I stopped, they only have about two notes that aren't of that scale. So very clearly wedded to that scale. Now, by contrast, if we look at, let's say, the Seguidilla that Carmen sings, and that's a crucial song, of course, because this is the moment when Don Jose's goose is cooked, because he's going to be overwhelmed by the exotic nature of this creature in front of him, swaying and seducing him. And her song starts with four bars of this. And so that sounds as if we're in the key of... And nothing in the opening of the phrase goes against that. So it could have gone... only it doesn't. And this is how Bizet actually carries on. So he's gone from that to that. And that's full of notes that are no part of the key that he appeared to have started in. What he has done, though, is he's taken those notes and he's just slid them upwards a bit. In fact, the bottom one also splits and produces another one down there. So you have that going to there. So that's completely off, completely abnormal for the sort of style of the rest of the score. And there's a sort of slinkiness about the way those harmonic parts move. But then the other part of the equation is that Bizet mustn't leave his audience too far behind. And when you consider that people's reactions were rather mixed to this opera, it's surprising when you consider how much he bent over backwards to accommodate Parisian taste. He himself was a Parisian. His audience was Parisian. He made sure he didn't upset his idea of what Spanish music might be by actually going to Spain. And at the end of this little passage as I'm playing, from here, we have... So actually, that is... which is absolutely the stuff of classical music. Cadences that you can find in the music of Bach abundantly. So he's introducing an exotic element, and then he's kind of bringing it back home for the audience. And in the meantime, whilst he's doing that, we have these rather Spanish-sounding decorations on the melody. And so on.
Very good.
So we're going to find...
No, Jonathan, sorry. Appreciate it. No, it's a masterclass that we're getting there, the Jonathan Darnborough masterclass on playing Bizet. And Susan, I want to move on to you, though, because we're hearing there about the slinkiness, about the genius, the heart of Carmen. And you're the internationally acclaimed expert on the work of Carmen. And I wonder, what is it that made Carmen such a popular, long-lasting, enduring success? Was it the music, the story, the combination of both, the fact that it is a storyline that's dark and controversial? What is it about Carmen that has made it such a classic?
Well, I would point to something that I think intersects with what Jonathan has been talking about, but Bizet brings popular music, the styles of popular music, into this opera. It's one of the things that was controversial at the beginning, may have been part of what Bizet meant by he now finding his true path. But the Habanera, for instance, was a song that was being sung in the cabarets at the time. Many of the pieces that Carmen sings are based on styles that are circulating in mass culture at the time. So that gives a kind of hook into the opera. Don José always sings in a very elevated manner, and in following the kinds of harmonic plans that Jonathan was explaining so well. But up against that, you have popular music. So you only have to hear the Habanera one time in your life, and you remember that forever. There are a lot of tunes in this opera that immediately hook you and that make you want to hear it again. Bizet is creating a strange hybrid between the elevated style and the styles of popular music that are circulating in the cabaret. We would call that today probably postmodernism, something like what Thomas Addis does so very, very well, bringing complex modernism and jazz together in scores like Powder Her Face. And so Bizet's opera is a very good starting place for someone who wants to get into opera, because so much of that score is immediately comprehensible, and then you are led into the complexities of the rest of the opera and the very deft way in which Bizet is weaving those together. I also think of Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, which similarly brings together popular genres and very, very complex modes of composition. And I think that those are the elements that really appeal in this opera. The storyline is, I think the librettists did a fantastic job. This is one of the great librettos of all time.
And they knew what they were doing. They boiled the story down in really ingenious ways to put it forward. But I think it's that mix of musical genres, of the straightforward, the kinds of things that you would have heard in the opera comique, like the Toreador song, like the music Micaela gets, but with this cabaret music, and then with the very elevated music that Don José is identified with, that mix of styles really cannot be resolved. And they come into collision at the end of the opera just as violently as José and Carmen themselves.
Laura, it is very interesting when you look at the story of Carmen and the ending of Carmen, the shocking violence at the end when Don José murders Carmen, and spoiler there for people who haven't seen it. But was that something that resonated in the years afterwards? Because you even see in more recent interpretations, there are attempts to maybe reinterpret that and maybe show it in a different way.
Yeah, the ending of Carmen is probably one of the most talked about moments in the opera. So in the decades after the opera had first been seen in Paris, there were some other works, other operas and ballets brought to the Parisian stage, which similarly, shocked audiences by showing, for example, pretty graphic violence or maybe very suggestive eroticism. So we could take a couple of examples. One might be the opera Ariane et Barbe Bleue, which, like Carmen, was also staged at the Opéra Comique in 1907. And that was a work by Paul Ducasse, which features two scenes that are quite striking that have a relationship, I think, to Carmen. There's one scene of quite graphic domestic violence, which I think could only have been acceptable because Carmen had helped to normalize that sort of spectacle in the kind of theatre culture by that time. And then there's another scene in Ariane as well, which is quite sort of a separate scene, which is quite kind of suggestive and again intended to be erotic. And again, that representation of gender and female sexuality could only have happened, I think, in a time where Carmen had become more acceptable as well. If we go forward now to think of more recent productions of Carmen, again, that ending has become kind of a sort of a crux for opera directors. And if we look at, there was a production in Florence in just about a year ago where the director decided to change the ending. So instead of having Carmen stabbed to death, instead she takes the gun and she shoots Don José. So the idea with that is that that ending has been interpreted in the lens of the Me Too movement as a kind of a woman asserting herself against this, aggressor and so on. But that ending has also been kind of framed in terms of, you know, what's actually happening in society, where the opera director made the point that in Italian society, there's still a very high prevalence of women who are murdered by their husbands or partners and so on. And so by focusing on that ending and changing it, they're drawing attention to a bigger social issue.
Very interesting. We are going to continue with our discussion of Carmen. But before that, Rachel, we asked you to choose a piece of music. And I think you've gone for something from one of his earlier operas.
Yes, this will be something completely different. This is a serenade from Don Procopio. It was an opera he wrote when he was in Italy, staying there because of winning the prize, the Prix de Rome. And he sent it back as one of the tasks he had to do to offer something back. It was never performed in his own lifetime. And then it was lost as well. So it only was found in 1894. And it got its first performance in 1906. I find this piece interesting because it seems to build on the tradition, the operatic romance tradition that went through 18th century French opera, starting with the very first one was by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who wouldn't be well known as an opera composer, but had a very successful opera, Le Devin de Village. And it was associated with a tenor in the 18th century because they were the big stars in opera in France. Around the Italian opera world, it had been the castrati who were the big stars in the 18th century, but it was high tenors in France. And I thought this would be a lovely way to show how Bizet used the tenor voice, and also because the tenor who was so popular when the Romance came into the opera, Pierre de Chéliot also played guitar, often on stage, and he was a maître de guitar for the French king. So this particular extract, you hear the guitar and mandolin, and so as well as echoes of Mozart and Rossini, you get the sense of what had been happening in the previous century.
History. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we look at the life, music and legacy of Bizet. Wolfgang, I'm very interested to know about how Carmen influenced not just other musicians, but writers and philosophers. Is it true that Nietzsche was influenced by Bizet?
Yes, indeed he was. And that is an interesting story because Nietzsche had a kind of a almost 180 degree turn at some point. He was a great fan of Wagner's and his operas for a long time throughout the 1870s. And then they fell out, which has as much personal reasons. Wagner didn't really reciprocate Nietzsche's admiration because Wagner essentially only loved one person, and that was himself. And so Nietzsche suddenly became Wagner's mortal enemy. And then he saw Carmen in Vienna. And he said, this is great. This is the best opera ever. This is now my new model. And you can do that in two ways in relation to Nietzsche's philosophy. There is this concept of the dichotomy of the Apollonian and the Dionysian principles. The Apollonian is the highbrow, cerebral, rational approach to art and to music in particular. He did this about ancient Greek tragedy, but it can be broadened out and applied to almost anything. And then there's the Dionysian element, Dionysos, the Greek god of wine, also known as Bacchus, to those of a Roman interest. And that is more about emotion, more about going with the flow and sort of immersing yourself in the moment. And he said you need both. It is wrong if you focus only on the Apollonian moment, as he thought most art did. We also need to have this what many regard as the lower moment. And that was what Carmen and the world of Carmen, the music of Carmen, which is regarded as more primitive, what Jonathan played earlier, for example. It is driven by rhythm. A lot of that is dance, whereas the other music, the music of Don José Micaela, is driven by melody, by lyrical, and that is regarded as more higher. And the other thing is the will to power that Nietzsche propagated and said the love, Carmen goes with the emotion, with the moment, with the love, and she is driven by this and run by this, and this is how the world really works, and everything else is not really there to the same degree real, and we should have this more in our life in a way, or it's more of a model for us. So he did that, and for the rest of at least until he went mad for another 10 years or so, this was his model, and said at some point, I've now seen, I think, Carmen 22 times, and I can't stop going and watching it. It's so wonderful. So that's fascinating, I thought. So.
Very good. Susan, we've had an interesting text in from Elizabeth in Rohini, one of our regular listeners. She's enjoying the show, and she wants to, me to ask the panel, what do they think Bizet would have made of Carmen Jones? And that's the film that was made with an all-black cast. And it's interesting to see the different interpretations of Carmen that have been done over the decades, including one starring Beyoncé Knowles that was, I think, Carmen, a hip hopera. And your work looks at that it's constantly being reinterpreted and reinvented.
Yes, and I think that's one of the extraordinary things about this piece. And I think that's made possible by this collision that Bizet already has there between high art and popular art. That invites revisions. It invites people on MTV to say, wow, he was doing that at his own time. What would it be like to put this collision between hip-hop and a higher mode of discourse. And of course, that's what attracted Oscar Hammerstein when he put together Carmen Jones, that you try to position that cultural collision in ways that draw on the tensions of your particular moment. In music history and in social history. And I think that we have so many more revisions of that piece drawing on later kinds of popular culture than we have of any other opera, because those tensions and that openness to revision is already present in Bizet's score.
So, Laura, if we were to recommend some Bizet for our listeners, would it be the obvious answer of Carmen, or would we suggest that they go further afield?
Well, you can't go wrong with Carmen, but I think there's a lot to be gained as well from exploring some of the other works. So, for example, there's his earlier opera, The Pearl Fishers, which I think has a lot to recommend it in terms of instrumental colour and the kind of exoticism for which Bizet is renowned anyway in Carmen. As I also said at the start, I find his first symphony, that symphony in C, even though he was only 17 when he wrote it, it's a really interesting introduction to a different side of him.
Very good. Well, we are going to leave it there, but we are going to play out with some music that Wolfgang is going to introduce. But for me, I would like to thank our wonderful experts tonight, Professor Susan McClary, Jonathan Darnborough, Professor Wolfgang Marx, Dr. Rachel Talbot and Dr. Laura Watson. That is the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Susan Cattle, to Chris Bent on sound, and to Peter Kyo, a transition year student from Donabate Community College, who is helping us out this evening. And many thanks to him as well. Next week, we're going to be looking at Michael Collins, The Man and the Myth, in our March book show. And in 2 weeks' time, we have a special show on the Dictionary of Irish Biography. So join us next week and the week after on News Talk. But to play out tonight, Wolfgang, what have you selected for us?
Well, it was the listener who you quoted earlier who already selected that. So it's probably the other best-known melody alongside the Habanera that opened the show, the Toreador song, which is, that is the love interest competitor in a way, Don Jose, who will later interest Carmen in himself. And this is what something, it was early on one of the hits of the show. There is a story about Bizet saying at some point, though this is actually rubbish for the crowd. We're not sure how ironic that might have been. It is certainly also representing, like Carmen, he Escamillo is one of the boastful, shallow characters. He's a lower, famous, yes, but lower social status. It is a strophic song, which indicates that, for instance. But it is something that you hear it once and you will never forget it. And so let's listen to it to conclude. Oui, songe en combattant, un œil noir te regarde, et que l'amour t'attend, Toreador, l'amour t'attend.